grace, as I tried to do, and that's a broader sense, to look at the Bible directly in aging, looks at those persons who are older, and or definite references to age and so on. That's what he does here. A theological perspective is provided by this one, J. Gordon Harris. I think he's American Baptist. Very, very well done. Looks in a deeper sense at the culture of the day, Israel's response to the culture of the day, and how that takes shape through the Old Testament story and into the New Testament story and theology, and then how it comes to us today. So, but it's a deeper theological kind of piece for that one. And then finally, I just also have received Honor Thy Father and Mother. It's a survey of the Jewish interpretation of what this is all about, by Rabbi Blidstein, I think is how it's pronounced. So some different things to show that there are some definite things that have been done on the Bible and aging, and you're welcome to look at any of those afterwards. Okay? We don't have a works person back here to start the machine, so we'll go and try it. If the power goes down, well, we'll go with that. Okay, all right. Somebody said you wasn't here. Okay, good. We do have a person back there. So, and I wasn't aware that we would. I was told that we wouldn't. Okay, good. I think we're ready to roll the tape. Again this morning, I'm Arden Barton, and I direct the Gerontology degree program at Lutheran Bible Institute. I've been there 2 years and am working with ministry and spirituality in aging, and specifically trying to see what Scripture has to say for us as we are in our own aging process, and as we seek to do ministry with older adults and with aging families. This morning we want to look at the aging family and how we might see that expressed in something happening in Ruth in the fourth chapter. First, let me begin with a few concepts about aging families, so that I just give a little bit of background framework in which to think about these things. I've drawn on the board, first of all, a timeline that goes from 0 to 100, just to think about the numbers of years that we might live. And if you just think quickly with me along the line, some of the things that happen with people from birth, beginning to learn and develop through childhood. As we get into the teens, we start to have some identity changes, some growing out of oneself and discovering new things. We have courtship and dating. That goes on a few years, and we have marriage. We may have some problems around any of those years, but we can have problems anywhere along the line if we perceive it that way. We have children born, and people taking shape with families in those early years, families of their own, what we've come to call the nuclear family. We also have education that's continuing, maybe after high school. Some go to college, maybe some are choosing career and joining the workforce or going to the military. There are other kinds of life decisions as we expand and reach out, take on more independence and more responsibilities. The children get older, and as we know, as they get older, parenting becomes even more of a challenge as we struggle with how much do we direct and guide and how much do we allow children to grow and discover, and all that dependence, independence, interdependence kind of issue keeps coming to us. But there are increases in expenses. We may by that time have purchased a home or rented a place. We are making choices about recreation. We're making choices about how much we'll spend with children. There may be health care needs for them or for ourselves. All those kinds of responsibilities tend to increase as we think about getting in through midlife.
Then the kids get older,
and we start to see them going on their own, leaving home, getting married, doing their own college, which requires expenses and concerns for us in different ways. Some of us may have older parents, we might feel some press from that side. Press for time and attention and energy. Press for finances sometimes, and personal caregiving may happen in all different kinds of ways. And so that sometimes makes people in here called the sandwich generation, people who feel responsibility from both sides, both directions. Then as we go along, we ourselves become more independent in a new way because children have left home. It used to be called the empty nest syndrome. That sort of suggested that that all of our energies were poured into our kids, and now what do? People have now started to use different terminology, and instead of empty nest, they talk about child-free time, which is a little bit more positive way to think about things. And so how do we now prepare for our time together as we grow older? How do we make choices about our continued growth and learning? How do we prepare for retirement and move through that? And then we might have some years of leisure time and of doing volunteer ministry. Then we may discover that we're facing some health challenges ourselves, and some limitations just due to natural aging. We may by that time have grandchildren. And then even as we grow older, great-grandchildren, and so on. So that as we mark the timeline up then, for any given time, we see that we have at a minimum of 3, usually 4 now, and even often 5 generations that make up the aging family. The reason I say it's an aging family is because it's not only the older people that are aging. See, we're all moving along the line at about the same speed. And the interesting thing that makes up the aging family is that we all have things going on with us at the same time. So that if there's a business loss or change or a career change or a divorce, or any kinds of things that happen in one part of the family, or a widowing, or any kind of thing that happens, it impacts the rest of the family. And the dynamics that are going on anywhere along the line may affect someone elsewhere. Even since I've been here, I've talked with someone whose children are all at far points of the country and even at far points of the world. Well, that impacts how this person feels in his or her identity. And needs. So that's the kind of a sense of the aging family. We need to know that there are lots of things to be considered. The second thing I want to raise is the notion of family structure. That if we look at any given person, we can think about, with some varying strengths of lines and drawing of circles, how people with whom we relate, where we have stronger relationships, where we give and receive in different kinds of ways. We might want to draw people who are gone from us. People who have died still continue to have an influence, and it's important for us to kind of remember who some of those key people are in different ways. Pets need to be included too. Sometimes they are an important part of our family structure. And the same with friends. We need to think of outside the family structure in the most immediate family. We need to think of who are the neighbors, who are the confidants, who are the Christian family that are important to a person. So that as we're relating to any person really in the family, but if we're thinking about persons in the aging process, and we want to have a sense of understanding them, it might be worth trying to draw what we might guess to be their family structure. Best yet, if we have them draw it. And it will give us a sense of what they perceive their family to be, and in fact, how we relate or where we fit in that for them. Family structure. There are rules, roles, and rituals that make up family structure. we aren't just there in relationship, but there are different kinds of ways that people function and operate. Some people are rescuers. Some are blamers. Some are demanders. Some are planners. Some are takers. We have all kinds of different roles that make up how people fit and the rituals of how those things take place. Some families have family reunions. Some never get together as families. So there are different ways that people are brought together. We also have secrets, family secrets, that change with the culture. It used to be that if someone went to the sanitarium, you know, had any need in mental health, that was a real mark on the family. Probably is still a secret or a stigma. Often is someone with a substance abuse problem. We like to think that we've come above that, and that's a place where we can share things like that and receive strength and support. Hard to bring those things out in the open. They can be family secrets and so on. Illegitimate childbirth and so on, all these kinds of things that we have in our own histories or in the histories of our families that we don't know where to fit. Secrets. Values is another key thing that shapes family structure, because people at different times and places discover different values. And so the values that may shape a college-age son or daughter may turn out to be quite different from what have shaped the lives of the parents at that stage, and so on. So the give and take in the value system has an impact upon family structure. Third thing I just want to talk about is the relationship of children and parents as we move through the years. We start out with a parent-child relationship, and we know that the care and nurture of the child and the responsibility for the child is a key role of the parents. We have tended to think that as we go through the years, that somewhere along the line that reverses, and that the children become parents to their own parents, and their parents become children. And there's what's called a role reversal. The way that that's come out is that people tend to say, well, my mother cared for me when I was in infants and changed my diapers. I've seen poems about this. And so therefore, as she is in her older years, that I can care for her is an important thing for me to do. And there is some sense in which that's true. However, I don't think it always is true, and sometimes that kind of a sense puts an undue responsibility and expectation upon either of the roles. Some parents, as they grow older, don't want to be treated like children. And some adult children, as they go through the years, don't want to take on the role of parenting their parents. So it's we have to be careful about that. I would prefer to talk about what is called filial maturity, in which we all become adults and we talk about relating together as adult to adult. Now, my own mother, for example, as I was a child, had certain rules and expectations for me, such that I always do my best. I do things in such a way that I am liked, and that so that I can be popular. I think another one is be on time. Well, so we've gone through the years, and I wanted to kind of mature and be independent in my own style. But even now, as I'm over in here somewhere, and she visits Eastern Bible Institute, what does she do? She goes around and checks with the other people. Have I been on time, and am I doing my best, and am I well liked? So she's carrying on some of those things. Well, I have to remember that to allow her to be herself. But as we go through the years, my hope is that I can be with her an adult, and she can understand and respect that I've had certain choices and values in life, and new roles and rituals, and we have to negotiate that. At the same way, as she grows older, I would hope that she can maintain herself as an adult and make responsible choices, and that we can care for one another in that. As certain things change in our family, economics and health and so on. So I would prefer to talk about an adult to adult kind of relationship, and so that we can give and receive with some kind of level of mutuality and interdependence. Well, enough introduction. We'll we'll hope to see some of those things come out as we look at Ruth chapter 4. Now, you know the story of Ruth, that Naomi marries Elimelech, and they have two sons, Chilion and Mahlon. And as there's a famine in Judah, they go to Moab, where there's things are more plentiful for the time. Chilion and Mahlon marry in Moab, young Moabite women. And it turns out, for some reason, and it's still true, the men are dying first. We know that to be very true statistically. So that first Elimelech dies, and then the two sons die, and we are left with this unique circumstance of a mother-in-law with two foreign daughters-in-law in a strange land. Well, the famine gets older, and Naomi says, I'm going home, I'm going back to my home country, and it's been a joy to be with you, and let's leave it at that. Well, the daughters-in-law say, no, wait a minute, we're family. So what are we going to do? And they have to think this through. Well, as you know the story, it's decided that Orpah decides to remain in Moab, and Ruth decides, however, to return with her mother-in-law. And that's the famous part of the story in chapter 1. Your people shall be my people, your God shall be my God. And so that Ruth adopts the faith and the nation and the race of Israel, and she is adopted by, through Naomi, adopted by that faith and that race and that nation. Well, they get back to Judah, and the question is how are they going to make it? How are they going to survive? Well, the system that provides for folks, their welfare system, is called gleaning. And so the way that they survive is going around after the crops are picked and taking what's left over. And that's, it's free. And the wealthy owner of this field, named Boaz, who is distantly related, somehow gets word that these people are here, and he says, leave a little extra for them. He extends himself a little farther to make sure that they're provided for, that welfare means for them that they fare well. I would like that we should think of welfare so fully. So they do fare well. But he goes beyond that because there's more at stake with them. As we see that the widowed Naomi, because of the social structure of Israel, either has to be provided for or she has to sell her property according to the laws of Israel, because widows don't have rights in Israel to own property in that sense, and to continue with a role in the history of Israel as they would have had with their married status. So for Naomi, who's widowed, this is a challenging time. It's a difficult time. She's past childbearing age. And so for her, it's a sad thing. That's one of the reasons she said daughters-in-law may as well stay in Moab, is because she's too old to provide sons for them so that they can remarry and continue the family line. It's a sad time for her, and she is sort of left with a life of dependency now, a kind of a miserable loneliness and loss of identity at this time. Well, Boaz is going to see something about this, and so he's going to take responsibility. Let's start with Ruth chapter 4. I'll read in three sections, and we'll make some comments, and then go on to the next section. And Boaz went up to the gate and sat down there, and behold, the next of kin, of whom Boaz had spoken, came by. So Boaz said, turn aside, friend, sit down here. And he turned aside and sat down. And then he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So they sat down. And then he said to the next of kin, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, is selling the parcel of land which belonged to our kinsman Elimelech. So I thought I would tell you of it and say, buy it in the presence of those sitting here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not, tell me that I may know, for there is no one besides you to redeem it, and I come after you. And he said, I will redeem it. Then Boaz said, the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you are also buying Ruth the Moabitess.
the widow of the dead, in order to restore the name of the dead to his inheritance. Then the next of kin said, I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I impair my own inheritance. Take my right of redemption yourself, for I cannot redeem it.
Well, they come before the elders at the city gate. So you might note that my first interest is in the elders. Who are these elders? And why are they there, and what's their purpose? Well, we go back in Scripture and we discover that even in the patriarchal times with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, we see that there's a role of the older person with the experience of lived faith who takes, there's a kind of a role of authority for any decisions that need to be made. They give advice and counsel, they make legal decisions, and so on. They just have that if you want to know how to live life fully, that's who you go to, is an elder. If you want to live life faithfully, that's where you would receive the advice and information to do so, because those are the people who've been through it. And they can turn over the stories and the values and give them to the younger generations. So that when there's an issue that comes before the people, or there's a place to give blessing at the feasts and festivals, that the elders are there representing the people in that regard too. This is formalized now into a social structure with Moses, Numbers 11, verse 24. Look with me, hold your hand in the place in Ruth, and let's turn to Numbers chapter 11, verse 24. And we know that this is the part of the story of the Exodus where Moses is feeling really frustrated. It's almost more than he can handle. What to do with all these people and all their complaining and all the problems that have come up? How can he handle all this? And so he comes to the Lord and says, Lord, what am I going to do? And so the Lord says, well, you go out to the people and you gather some of the elders. And we'll form kind of a giant council to prayerfully support and guide the people. So Numbers 11:24, Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord, and he gathered 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around about the tent. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him and took some of the spirit that was upon him and put it upon the 70 elders. And when the spirit rested upon them, they prophesied. But they did so no more. Well, there's a special anointing and a giving of office to the 70 elders of Israel. There turns out that there are two more back in camp who, in a sort of a charismatic way, get a spiritual blessing also. So we have the 70 plus the two, really makes the 72 elders in the history of Israel. Well, those people carry on and continue to represent in very formal ways. Well, here we see them at the gates of the city and for Boaz, because if he's going to get involved in this whole legal and situation and the situation of the faith and nation of Israel, he wants to be sure that it's done on the up and up, and it has the blessing of the elders of the people, and indeed through them, God's blessing. It's all the way it needs to be. Okay, let's go on with verse 7. Of chapter 4 of Ruth. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning redeeming and exchanging. To confirm a transaction, one drew off his sandal and gave it to the other. And this was the manner of attesting in Israel. So when the next of kin said to Boaz, buy it for yourself, he drew off his sandal. Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, you are witnesses this day that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and to Mahlon. Also Ruth the Moabitess I have bought to be my wife, the widow of Mahlon, I have bought to be my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead in his inheritance, and the name of the dead that it may not be cut off from among the brethren from the gate of his native place. You are witnesses this day. Then the people who were at the gate and the elders said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel.
May you prosper in Ephrathah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the children that the Lord will give you by this young woman.
Well, there's very strong reference there that Ruth, who is a Moabite woman, is brought in and given full privileges and responsibility, just as good as Rachel and Leah and Tamar, other women who have had a share in the unfolding of the plan of salvation through the history of Israel. Ruth is brought into that, and she's given full membership in the faith and nation and history of Israel.
Now, what's at stake here? I said that widows don't have any rights in Israel in terms of property and legal status, so that if the situation for Naomi is to continue without any husband and no sons to take these legal rights and to provide a place and a context for her, she has to sell a property and she's left kind of out on the streets in a sense. But it's more than that. She has a loss of identity with the people of Israel because she no longer has posterity to be a part of the nation and a part of the promises of God as they unfold in the future. And that's a very significant loss. It's a change of identity and a loss of status. We know what it means for our culture that widows struggle financially, that widows try to maintain homes and other kinds of things that make it difficult just on the day-to-day life with the cultural structure that we have. Well, how much more because of the faith dynamics that surround Naomi in this instance. So she's facing a lot. This is in some sense to say that a woman in this state, it's in really some sense the end. Okay, so Boaz wants to do something about this. Boaz extends himself beyond the physical care into saying that there's something more that he wants to do. And what he's doing is taking on two roles here. The first is the role of the levirate husband, according to the law of levirate marriage. So look with me at, again, hold your hand in Ruth 4, and look with me at Deuteronomy, Chapter 25. And this is Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. There we go. Chapter 25, and I will start at verse 5. If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of the husband's brother to her. And the first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his brother who is dead, that his name may not be blotted out in Israel. And if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate of the elders and say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. And if he persists, saying, I do not wish to take her, then his brother's wife shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull off his sandal from his foot and spit in his face, and he shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And the name of his house shall be called Israel, and the house of him that had his sandal pulled off. Well, so what happened here? There was a brother, apparently, that to Naomi's deceased husband, but he was willing to do this to start with. But you see, it wouldn't have much value. It wouldn't be much involved, much risk. He could get the land without much risk if Naomi's the only one because she's past childbearing age. There isn't much more to happen beyond that. And so he's willing to do that much. But as soon as it's suggested that, wait a minute, now with that you get more. You get Ruth. And there's some responsibility toward Ruth too.
Well, we don't know what reason. Maybe it was because she was a foreigner. Was it a racial question? That somehow it seemed he thought he might risk his own inheritance. Didn't know what that all meant, but he decided he couldn't do it. So Boaz, who is first or second cousin, you know, once or twice removed, how do we say that? A little farther up in the family structure, says that he's willing to step in to this levirate role. And so he's willing to come forth as a kinsman and to take this on, to fulfill the law of levirate marriage, and to make sure that that Naomi will continue in the Israel family, and to have the property and have the name and have the posterity. The second thing that Boaz fulfills is the law of the Redeemer, or the role of the Redeemer, the Goel, as it's called in Hebrew. He's willing to step in to take the responsibility of redemption. To redeem means to give value back by paying a price. So not only does he buy back the property for Naomi, but he buys also her family name and future. And he's very intent that this is what's happening, to perpetuate the family name. And he will, since she's past childbearing age, he already knows that that's going to happen with Ruth, the daughter-in-law. Okay? That's the law of the Redeemer. We find that, again, hold your hand in Ruth 4, and look this time at Leviticus chapter 25. And again, we'll start at verse 25 there. If your brother becomes poor and sells part of his property, then his next of kin shall come and redeem what his brother has sold. And if a man has no one to redeem it, and then himself becomes prosperous and finds sufficient means to redeem it, let him reckon the years since he has sold it and pay back the overpayment to the man to whom he has sold it, and return what is his property. But if he has not sufficient means to get back for himself, then what he sold shall remain in the hand of him who bought it until the year of the Jubilee, and the Jubilee it shall be released and shall return to be his property, and so on. Well, the law of redemption that it carries through. Down at verse 47, we see the foreigner brought into the picture. If a stranger or sojourner with you becomes rich, and your brother beside him becomes poor, and sells himself to the sojourner, to the stranger or sojourner with you, or to a member of the stranger's family, then, after he has sold, he may be redeemed. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle, or his cousin may redeem him, or a near kinsman belonging to his family may redeem him. If he grows rich, he may redeem himself. So you see that Boaz has sized this situation up, and he sees that he's the one who can step into this role and take this on. Now, I've been in studies before where we've applied some of our current values to this study, and people have suggested that Boaz was really an exploiter at this point. He saw this as a chance to take advantage of these women's plight and to get more property and add to his wealth. Well, because of the nature of these laws and of the faith involved, I really just have to reject that interpretation. I think that Boaz did not need to do this. I think that he was a man of faith, and he extended his concern to these kinswomen and wanted to step into those roles and made a conscious choice about that. I think that he chose to have less that they might have more. I really believe that this was an act of grace, and that God was able to use this for much more, as we shall see. The law of levirate marriage and the role of the Redeemer, and Boaz moved into those. Again, before the elders of the city, so that all is done above the board, and that the faith is upheld, and the rules of the nation are upheld. And something can be happened for the redemption of Naomi and of her family. Last section, verses 13 and following. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord, who has not left you this day without next of kin, and may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has borne him." Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her bosom and became his nurse. And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, "A son has been born to Naomi." They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, who in turn was the father of David. I think this is a wonderful climax to this story. As you maybe can tell from some of my interest and enthusiasm, a very beautiful thing happens here. Ruth has a child, and Naomi is blessed. The women gather around kind of like a circle, or search study group, or a prayer fellowship. I'm not sure what kind of a group they are, but they gather around and they are very aware of what's going on with Naomi and her feelings and in her needs. And as this child is born, they are rejoicing. So that they bless Naomi and they bless Ruth and they bless the child, and they are just so glad for what has been given back to Naomi. They observe the redeeming nature of this whole experience and how God has taken some very unique circumstances and used the laws of the land and the culture of the people to bless and provide for Naomi in her older years. So it is not just the physical provision for her as a widow and for her family that's been taken care of, but indeed much more has been redeemed as her property has been retained and redeemed. But more than that, her identity and her place in the history of Israel. She will have family and she will have posterity. And she will be, you know, it's renowned in Bethlehem. Such that indeed it is out of the stump of Jesse and out of the house and lineage of David that a new Redeemer will be born. See, who will redeem not only widows, and others in older, and men too, in older age, but people of, men and women of younger age, a redeemer of another sort. Okay. A restorer of life and a nourisher in old age. The intergenerational care that's hinted at here, through relationship, through just having family. And again, we're talking about family structure. We're talking about the generations. And the things that are happening that flow from one generation to another that give meaning and give life. That's partly how we are nourished and restored and maintained and sustained throughout our years. I think it's a wonderful piece of this story. Now think what this means in a patriarchal society where the property is owned and passed on through the men and so on. What is being said to Naomi here? This daughter-in-law, this young woman who's even a foreign-born, is more to you than seven sons. Who needs men when you have a daughter-in-law like that? And what a powerful sense of relationship that has grown out of that love and devotion that established way back there in Moab, but now is given life and given fruitfulness here. But shown in that powerful statement in the midst of a patriarchal society which says, you know, more to you than seven sons. You don't need that. Here it's been given to you through the blessing of the Lord. What else can we discover out of this? Grandmother and grandchild relationships. Ruth, of course, as daughter-in-law, steps aside for a time, and Obed is actually given to Naomi. And she takes him as nurse, grandma and grandson, even as mother and son for a time, so that the family bonds are sealed and this family is set in place for all posterity, even to take a place in the ancestry of our Lord Jesus Christ. I just think that's powerful stuff.
What else can we learn about this? What about the sense of extended family?
Here's Boaz, who has, you know, in his wealth, could be kind of paternalistic, I suppose, and say, oh, there's some neat people, you know, provide for them, even leave a little extra. But I think that really would be to undercut what he is about. He really extends himself. I think one could say maybe above and beyond the call. I see it quite the opposite of exploitation. I see him as a man of faith that responds to some wonderful things of people that he cares for, and he himself, in filial maturity, in a life of faith, responds to that and gives and receives from them. And there's more to it here than meets the eye.
We can get hints of that. Let's look, by the way, just turn back a page to chapter 2. Down at verse 10, you see, first off, as they're being provided for, Ruth sees herself as the receiver of grace. Verse 10, chapter 2, she says, then she fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to him, why have I found favor in your eyes, that you should take notice of me when I am a foreigner? But Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord recompense you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. Ah, she says, you've been most gracious to me, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your maidservant, though I'm not even one of your maidservants. See, what a relationship that's built on grace and understanding. Now, but the table is turned. See, Boaz is a little older himself. And he sees himself as a receiver of grace. So go over to chapter 3 and down to verse 10 of that chapter. This is the part, you know, where Naomi has kind of seen some of the handwriting here. And she kind of gives Ruth some coaxing to go over and spend a little time with Boaz. And so she says, go and get under the end of his sleeping bag at night and just kind of show that there's some interest here. You can just picture Boaz kind of waking up, pulling some sleep from his eyes. He senses something out. What's happening here? Well, he says, verse 9, who are you? She answered, I am Ruth, your maidservant. Spread your skirt over your maidservant, for you are next of kin. And he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. And so on. And so he invites her to stay the rest of the night. But I don't think there's any sexual involvement yet. Again, that was suggested in this previous Bible study that, aha, this was an exploitation and a chance for Boaz. I don't think there's any of that. I think that he keeps everything above the board and according to faith. In the next few lines, in fact, you'll notice that they get up early in the morning before there's light enough to see who's who and where's where. And he says, let's just keep this between us that you were here. No one needs to know this. We'll take care of it tomorrow. And so that's this chapter that we have read. He sees himself as an older man, as really a receiver of grace. You know, not only has Naomi been loved by this young woman, but here is Ruth, who is so appreciative, is giving him all the respect and care and willing to love him too. And he says, that's really pretty neat. So he's willing to take that, but he wants to receive it with proper understanding and a life of faith. Well, some marvelous things about the about a family that could have different roles
and could let one another go, but instead there are some interrelationships and there are things that are happening around an aging experience of aging. And it seems to me that God has used some people in some circumstances within the culture of their day to make some wonderful things happen. I think that's a significant thing for aging. And it says to me that as we think about aging families, family structures, roles with that can have some mutuality and grace, that that God can work among these things. And there is a redemption that can take place about the whole experience of aging and some very positive roles and images for us to look at. Your comments and thoughts. Now, I've done this a little more lecture style today, and I realize that. I hope it hasn't been such a way that you can't stay involved. But now, where are you, and what feelings come out for you this morning out of this?
I perceive Ruth as a very lovable, adorable girl right from the start, and she seems to have influenced everybody she comes in contact with, and I think that's probably where love comes in, so that people sort of fell for her and loved her in return very easily, as it is spoken in the case of Naomi and also the Boaz.
Well, that was an innate gift in terms of the way God created her, or whether she heard well the laws of her mother-in-law, you know, love God first with all your heart and soul and might and strength, and second, love your neighbors yourself. Maybe she just took those to heart.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not the center. Self is not the center for Ruth.
You get the feeling that she was, as we would say now, quite a girl.
Quite a girl, yes. Uh-huh. Sure. Anyone else?
Yes, I figured there when Ruth was suggesting, or Naomi suggested that Ruth go to Boaz, I think that was according to the customs of the day there. I don't feel that there was anything sexually there. It says she just laid at his feet, and he didn't even want that known. He protected her reputation. And then later on, it says that Ruth told her that he would take care of the business, which he immediately did then. He talked to the kinsman and finally bought the place. So I think it was up and above board. It was just the custom of the land.
Yeah, I don't know how, you know, we have a picture of courtship from our day, and probably even my day was different from a generation. Some of you here are enough 10, 15, 20 years ahead of me. I mean, I don't know. There are courtship and things are different. We know in other cultures that marriages are arranged. So, I think that that's true. I hadn't thought about that. That maybe that's the way that you showed a level of romantic interest or a willingness to share a marriage relationship. How would you do that? I suppose that's one, culturally how it was done.
Especially since there was the age difference and Naomi had no others except this, like, second or third cousin or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way you approached him and let him know that you were interested in marriage or whatever.
Yeah, that's kind of, I like that.
Mm-hmm. In King James, it says, she laid at his feet until morning, and she rose up before one could know another. And he said, let it not be known that a woman came to the floor.
Yeah.
So here it definitely says in King James.
Yeah. Almost before dawn, you know, it sort of suggests at least not enough light so you could see who was moving about and to recognize who was where.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they could be kept just between them, and they could know that this is what was going to happen. Other thoughts?
It reminded me of my own relationship with my mother-in-law. My mother died when we had just been married 2 years, and she said, that's all right. She said, don't grieve too long. I will be your mother.
Huh.
She was the most beautiful woman I've ever known.
Huh.
And it makes me angry when I hear these mother-in-law stories.
Sure, there was a redeeming. Sure, you you know, we don't have to say. There's, a conscious choice of someone who's willing to say, I will move in to the mother role, you know. Not that we can ever replace what another person has been, but we can replace the role, and we can give grace to grace, giving and receiving in special ways. Yeah. Family extending. You know, isn't that the meaning of what extended family maybe really means? Sir, other thoughts?
Naomi knew the laws of the Israelites, and she took advantage of them. She asserted herself for herself and her daughter-in-law by sending Ruth to Boaz, hoping that he would do what the kinsman should do. And I see in this, things are much, much more complicated today, but older people need to know the laws of our land that are designed to help them and take advantage of them and assert themselves to know what those laws are and how they can provide themselves by knowing what those laws are and taking advantage of them.
Yeah, there's a lot provided in culture, and one of the interesting discussions from the first hour was, can we transfer this language to our culture? One wonders whether in our American quote culture, whether we have enough cultural structure that there is even a flow, you know, that we do provide. It's an interesting thing to think about. Are we maybe in some sense almost a non-culture culture? We have a lot of laws in some ways, but I don't know how much culture we have. Yeah.
It seems to me that Ruth being Moabite was a pretty wonderful thing, that she could become so important in the Jewish structure of the family and leading to Jesse and David. And mm-hmm, mm-hmm. He almost went, almost like maybe predestination stuff, but I don't believe in it, but I mean, it's almost planned.
You mean that, like, is God's role and call for her? Something
yeah.
Like that?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Well, I certainly think that it shows how God can take a set of circumstances, any time or any set, any place in culture and time, and make some wonderful things happen with them. And they're not just there for unto themselves, but are seen even as a larger picture in the unfolding plan of salvation. You know, some wonderful things can happen. I suppose one could look today and to think, I wonder what there are in terms of interracial marriages today, or the spouses that have come from Vietnam or from the mission field, or other things. You know, I have experienced things. One, after I made a presentation at a congregation, there's one came up to me, and we got talking about church things, but it turned out what she really wanted to talk about was an extended family situation where, as a missionary in younger years, she had met and married someone relative to the mission field. And so the church rejected her because missionaries weren't supposed to marry. Some of the family rejected her because she came home with this, a Frenchman. And she just experienced a whole lot of cutting off. You know, one wonders about where we are with some things in the church. In the church, we have had, I hope we're doing better with it now, but we have had widows of clergy, deceased clergy, who are in poverty. It would seem a sad commentary on our experience and expression of the faith that we have not provided for those spouses who have gone where the call has taken them. You know, and now what have we done? That's it. I think we need to really take some note about that. Maybe there are other things too. Yeah.
One of the problems some people have with this story is that they don't have that kind of relationship in their lives. That their daughters-in-law, their sons-in-law, are sources of grief. Or their mothers-in-law, regardless of how wonderful some may be, do not meet any kind of standards of help and hope. Would you speak to that, please?
Well, sure. As we look at family structure, I don't know how we would draw it. Instead of circles, I suppose there are going to be some that are squares in the family structure. Just as we give and receive grace, I think each of us have persons in our family structure that drain energy and drain spirit. Probably the question is in perspective as how we see that in light of faith and ministry. That maybe we need to extend ourselves beyond just our social situation and see it in light of faith. What kinds of second, third, and fourth mile efforts are required sometimes in order to maintain relationships? Yes, indeed, we do see families where I don't know whether it's self-centeredness or maybe it's frustration sometimes, disappointment, other kinds of things. Yes, we see people who are cut off and not regarded as a part of the family anymore. And I've heard people, I've met people where it's just as if they never have someone. My very first funeral, as I tell you this, in my graduate year, I was a hospital chaplain, working as a floor chaplain, Lutheran Deaconess Hospital in Minneapolis. And the funeral home had someone that they had no contact for family, didn't know the background of this individual, and so they thought, well, maybe at least one of the hospital chaplains would come over and provide the service. So I went over, and it was kind of an interesting context for me because it was a chance to have a funeral service and kind of get started in that direction in terms of ministry. But at the funeral service, it turned out some people did show up. There were two or three street people who had been kind of family to this individual. But interestingly enough, there were family that came. There were two or three family that came from a far land. Somehow they had heard at a distance that there'd been the death and they came. And so as I met with them afterwards, they said, well, it's really a stranger that we're honoring today. It is not our father or uncle, because there have been some things happened at which there had been a sort of an abandonment of sorts, and they had cut off from him and had never had contact all those years. Very, very loose keeping track of where he was. And so they came, it was interesting the way they talked about it. It was so impersonal that I thought, I was curious as to what was at work within them that they should even come and take note of his passing. But hope that maybe there was some blessing in the message and the time we spent together to hopefully be redeeming maybe about that situation. I don't know if that helps. Those are some things that come to my mind. Aging families, family structures, and the roles that we play in them can be very complicated. I don't want to presume, as I see some beauty and see some call for redemption of aging persons and the meaning of aging and aging process here in the Book of Ruth, I don't want to presume to think that it's always wonderful. I think of what it does is it gives us some modeling and it gives us some hope that there are some ways that we can think about those who are the siblings, the sons and daughters, and the in-laws, mother, father, or daughter, son, the in-laws in our own families. And even the next of kin, not just the next of kin, but those extended. We hear some wonderful stories of some great aunts or some uncles or other people who've interacted and become wonderful part of families. We've heard some others where there's some tragic stories. What I think this raises with the role of levirate marriage or of that kind of extending into relationship, and also with the role of the Redeemer, I think it gives us possibility to think redemptively rather than just sociologically or psychologically, so on, but to think redemptively of relationships and of persons.
Just what is meant by this term levirate relationship?
Well, that's the levirate marriage that we looked up where in the culture of Israel, in the laws of Israel, it was provided that if you have a widow who has no sons, see, someone has to step in and make sure that there are sons so that the family name is carried on. Well, we don't have a cultural structure like that, but we can still think, what I'm suggesting is that we might think of other ways in which we might step in and see other things that may be provided for.
Another question, those arrows on the top there going toward each other.
Uh-huh.
I understand the progress of aging, but what are the two on top?
Okay, what I was drawing there was the fact that for some people in between, there is what we call sandwich generation. In other words, as we think about the different kinds of responsibilities and pressures as we go through the years, of our children and grandchildren, that sometimes we also experience demands and pressures from the generation above us, so that we feel squeezed in between. Mm-hmm. We only have so much energy and so much money and so much potential. And sometimes it puts so much that it can be very difficult for someone in that spot. And because we can have four generation and five generation families, there are families in which there are two sandwich generations. And it's just something for us to be aware of as we think about people around us. And when we take time to listen to stories, we begin to hear some of the feelings that are represented in all these things today. Thank you for being here.